Today is October 22nd, 2015. This is a Society of Women Engineers Grassroots Oral History Project interview with Dr. Jane Zimmer Daniels. The interviewer is Troy Eller English, and we are at the WE15 Annual Conference in Nashville, Tennessee. Jane was the director of the Purdue Women in Engineering Program from 1978 through 2001, and director of the Claire Booth Luce Program from 2001 through 2011. She is a fellow of the Society of Women Engineers and a Distinguished Service Award recipient. She is also a fellow of the Association of Women in Engineering. She is a Distinguished Education alumna from Purdue University. She received the Vincent Bendix Minorities in Engineering Award from the American Society for Engineering Education, and she was the founder of WEPAN. Thank you for being here today.
You're welcome.
To begin with, can you tell me when and where you were born?
Sure. I was born in 1946. That makes me almost ready for my 70th birthday this year, next year. And I was born in St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay. And could you tell me about your family?
Sure. I was born to parents who were older when they married. They were 37, and when I was born, they were both 42. So that was very unusual in that at that time. I had a brother who was 3 years older than I was, and he actually ended up becoming a civil engineer. So that was kind of a coincidence with the work I was doing. My parents owned a grocery store in St. Louis, and so I really grew up working in the store from little bitty. I mean, when we were very small, they would let us pull the cans and packages forward to make the shelves look pretty. And then we could help shop for people who called in orders. That was kind of common in those days. We were a neighborhood store, and so we would take the groceries to them in their homes and stuff like that. And my brother did too. We played hide and seek in the store when it was closed. We played in the backyard where they had a big old incinerator to burn boxes and things. It was just a fun childhood, really.
Okay. What was the name of that store?
Zimmer's Fine Foods in South St. Louis.
Okay. How did you decide to study sociology?
Okay, well, that fast forwards pretty quickly through grade school and high school. But in high school, I took a sociology course, and I was just really interested in the idea. And it's funny when I look back now that it was that early, but I thought it was fascinating to study how people interacted with each other and in organizations, which, you know, my whole life has been spent with leading organizations and doing committee work in organizations. So I'm sure that kind of prompted me to choose sociology to try and understand better how people work together.
Okay. And you went to Washington University.
I went to Washington University in St. Louis. And it's kind of interesting because as I began counseling students, I look back at myself and why didn't I ever think about engineering? My brother did, and my parents were not college educated, but they certainly supported anything we thought we wanted to do. And I wondered, why did he get the idea about engineering and I didn't? And my SAT scores looked just like the students that came to Purdue. I was much stronger in math and than I was in English, but I was a good student in both. And when I went to Washington U, my advisor, who was actually an assistant dean, said to me, I had signed up for my classes first year in calculus and chemistry, along with other courses. And he said, oh, honey, you don't want to take calculus and chemistry. And I said, I really liked them in high school. And he said, yes, but they're very hard here. You'd be competing with students in engineering and math majors. And I said, well, do you think my background's not good enough to succeed? And he said, oh, no, your background's very strong. As a matter of fact, you don't have to take another math course to get your degree. I had through trig and analytic geometry. And so I was a young 17-year-old freshman, and I said, okay. I mean, I thought he knew what he was talking about. And so I didn't, and I never took another math course until I took statistics working on my PhD. Mm-hmm. That was how discouraged it was.
Did you know that you wanted to go into counseling at that time?
Yeah, or? Except I thought I wanted to be a counselor in high school.
Okay.
So in St. Louis, you could get a bachelor's degree in just about anything. And then begin a counseling position in high school while you earned your master's in counseling. So I thought that was the road I wanted to choose. Well, I ended up falling in love with a young man that was starting to work at Purdue University. And so the rest is kind of history. I worked for 1 year in St. Louis as a caseworker for the welfare department. And then I moved to Indiana. And in Indiana, the laws are completely different. You cannot counsel in high school unless you've taught for 2 years or 4 years. I mean, it was quite a rigorous difference in understanding what you could do as a counselor. So I had absolutely no interest in teaching, no background, didn't think I'd be very good at it. Probably true. And so I thought, okay, now what do I do? You're in a college town with a bachelor's degree. Well, you and 99% of the people that live there. So I finally decided to go back and work on a master's degree while I was working. My first job at Purdue was I was a music librarian at the campus radio station. And so it left me enough time, and Purdue always encouraged employees to take classes and made it very easy for you to do so. So I began taking classes, working toward a master's in counseling, and then eventually, years later, went on and got a PhD there too.
Okay, okay. How did you, what led you to the Women in Engineering program at Purdue?
Yeah, it was an interesting path from music librarian to the Women in Engineering program. I worked at the music as a music librarian for about 6 years. And near the end of that, they allowed me to do other things at the radio station. And one of the things they were beginning to do was to put courses on the air at night, and students could listen to them and take final exams for the course and pass them that way. And one of the courses they asked me to help be a production assistant for was an introduction to geosciences. So every Tuesday and Thursday, I would walk across campus with the head of the geosciences department who was giving the course, and we'd talk, and I would mic him and listen to the class, and like if he would point to an illustration, I wouldn't personally, but I'd write down what he was doing, and then the announcers back in the studio would break in and say, at this point, Dr. Coulerud looked was talking about the illustration on page 14 of your text, or whatever it was. So we walked back and forth, and as I said, we just talked about what I was doing, and I was almost finished with my counseling degree, but not quite. And he said, at the end of the semester, we'd really like you to come counsel our students. We don't have such a person in our department. The faculty are doing all the counseling, and they don't know what they're doing, is what he said. Of course they did, but so I did. I went over there. And like engineering, there's a dearth of women in geosciences, particularly geology, meteorology a little less so, oceanography a little less so, but still quite sparsely populated with women at that time. This was in the early 1970s, I would think. And so I did. I became a counselor there and, like I said, noticed that for the first time and decided to ask if we could offer a course for all students, but thought we'd try to bring some female role models into the class as well as males to talk to the students. So I did that, and I worked in that department for 3 years. Well, as you work in a department, you get to meet counselors in other areas, and there was organizations for counselors and that sort of thing. So I met the director of Women in Engineering, who happened to be a personal friend from another environment. So she kept saying, oh, I love the work I'm doing. It's just so much fun. And she worked as a counselor also in the Department of Freshman Engineering. And so about a year after that, she said to me, there's an opening in our department. I want you to come over. She said, we have the best department chair and everything's wonderful. So I interviewed for it. I got the job. It was half time, which was fine with me because I had a young child at this point in time. And so I began counseling in the Department of Freshman Engineering, and then helping her with some of the Women in Engineering events and things. So the first year I was there, I became an advisor, co-advisor for SWE with her. And then less than a year later, she decided to move and take a position with Corning Incorporated to help them recruit and retain women engineers. And so the position became open. I didn't take it right away, actually. I turned it down because it was a full-time position, and I didn't think I wanted that yet. And the woman that took the job hated it. She thought it was high pressure. She didn't enjoy it at all. And she didn't, I don't think, philosophically really agreed with the idea of special programs for women. So after only about 6 months on the job, she announced that she wanted to leave. And I called Marie, my friend, on the phone, and I said, "They're offering me the position again. What do you think?" And she said, "I don't think opportunity knocks three times." She said, "I think you should take it." So I did, and just absolutely loved the position. It was interesting and fun. And
mm-hmm. What was her name?
Marie McKee.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when you became the director of the program, what was the atmosphere like for women engineering students at that time? Why was there a need for that program?
Right. It was interesting because it was good and it was bad. Purdue was the very first women in engineering program in the country, but that was back in 1969. So there'd actually been two other directors before Marie McKee. And so I thought, well, things are great for women here. They care. Mm-hmm. And I thought that would be a positive thing. It was, but the negative thing was that what the faculty and administration wanted was someone to go out and find young women, encourage them to come to Purdue in engineering, and then help them do engineering just like the white males did it. And so it was kind of a, I thought it, in my own mind, kind of find them and fix them sort of thing. It wasn't a valuing of the differences they brought. It was more wanting them to adapt to the culture the way it was. So I did that for a few years, but my consciousness was certainly raised during that period of time, and very rudely raised. One time I went to a meeting to talk about Purdue's programs, and we were so proud of our programs, and we had a higher proportion of women than any school in the country. And at the meeting, when I was talking, I responded to questions, and someone said to me, "How dare you find these young women and then make them change their way of doing things to fit what the white engineers teach and students perform and that sort of thing?" And boy, did that knock me back on my heels. It was like, that really isn't a very ethical thing for me to be doing if I care about women's education. Mm-hmm. So that sort of was a turning point for me. And after that, I tried to add programs, change programs, talk with faculty to help them understand that there are small things they could do in the classroom that would make it much easier for the young women to do their best work and succeed in engineering. So that was kind of the beginning of an evolution of the programs. Now when I go back to campus, it's just amazing because the faculty have truly bought into the idea that they want to teach and help every student learn as well as possible. So just a gigantic shift in the faculty attitudes. And I think the whole engineering field, thanks to SWE and WePAN and other organizations, is just much more aware of the value of letting the differences come to the table, to whether it's education or whether it's producing a product or a process or whatever, that diversity is making it better rather than making it more difficult.
Did you get any pushback from the faculty in doing this?
Or? Not really pushback. At the first, two things were going on. One was that it was a new idea to them, and so they were reluctant to believe me or to change quickly. The other thing was I only had a master's degree at that point in time, and engineering faculty are, I say this in the kindest way, so because so many of my friends are rather arrogant about their academic background. And so they thought I didn't have a PhD. I surely didn't know things as well as they knew things. Mm-hmm. Well, and that's sort of why I went back and got the PhD. And it made me happy and it made me angry because the day I got my PhD, you could absolutely see a difference in the way faculty responded to me. Mm-hmm. Now that might be my perception and not reality. But I certainly felt that way.
Okay. Did you... Was there a lot of dropout of women engineering students?
No. Even from the beginning, the retention of the women was far better than the men. Although it was funny, we would talk about that sometimes. The retention of the men increased as well at the time that the enrollment of women was rising. So it was almost like it did create a better environment. Mm-hmm. Just them being there made the men more interested in what they were doing, I guess. And so the retention for both groups went up. But for women, it was from the very beginning, it was higher than it was for men. And I think part of that was the self-selection sort of thing. For women to choose an unpopular career for girls, I'm sure we got the best of the best. The girls that were very strong in math and in science and in just ability to begin with. And I think because of our pre-college programs, they understood better what they were getting into. Mm-hmm. We talked to them about the curriculum. We talked to them about the classrooms. We talked to them. We had alumni talk to them about what they would be doing on the job. So they, earlier than the men, had a kind of a advanced knowledge about what they were getting into. And I think that helped retention, too.
Okay. So... Were there memorable successes or challenges in your tenure?
Honestly, there weren't too many challenges. There were lots of successes, and that's what made the job so interesting and so fun. When you're working with students that are so academically capable, it's a really easy job. Mm-hmm. Even those who decided to leave engineering, they had wonderful choices available to them in other majors because they were able to do anything they wanted to. So that part was really easy and really fun. The only challenge that I can recall really coming up against, and it helped me understand now when I see women engineers in the workforce, is what a difference a supervisor or a department chair in our situation could do. And in this whole length of time I was at Purdue as director of women in engineering, which ended up being 25 years or more, I only had one department chair that was difficult to work with. But he made my job so much less fun, and I was less enthusiastic about what I was doing. I really had a bad attitude for a couple of years, and made me think about leaving the position even. So that helped me understand that the people you report to can sure make a difference in how you do your work and how excited you are about the next day.
Okay. Can you tell me about the SWE section at Purdue?
Sure. It was wonderful. When I came in 1978, I think, as director of women in engineering, there were 700 SWE members at Purdue, student members. The national organization, and you can check this out because this is only what I remember, but I believe the national organization in total, students and professionals, was 7,000.
That sounds about right.
So we had 10% of the entire national SWE membership on campus as students. And the organization in those days was very different. It was predominantly students because that's where we were seeing the increases. And by the time they worked through the workforce, you know, it was still a long time before the workforce grew that fast. Mm-hmm. So it always felt to me like the organization was more responsive to the professionals and did not give the students much of a voice in the organization. Probably rightly so, but at the time it seemed unfair to me. I thought, well, why don't they listen to what the students want more for the organization than the professionals? But as it worked out, I'm sure it was fine. But that was, SWE at Purdue was very powerful on campus. It was the largest student organization in a student body of 35,000 students. So it was, had a lot of respect, a lot of power, also a lot of discrimination. Mm-hmm. Those were the days when programs for women were not really accepted as positive. It was like, well, then why don't you have a program for men? And they certainly didn't understand that every engineering program was a program for men because it was 90% men. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit bad. And one year in particular, when you talk about challenges, I guess this was another one. The Society of Women Engineers belonged to an association of all engineering students. And they produced a magazine that once a year, usually at the end of the school term, they would do a kind of a spoof magazine. And one issue, they decided to do their spoof magazine against female engineers. And they had some very rude, inappropriate cartoons and jokes and things like that throughout the magazine. Well, the SWE counselor at that time was a professor in electrical engineering named Violet Haas. And she was totally offended. I was totally offended. And she immediately called the advisor for the organization and the leaders of the organization, who, of course, were all men. And this is an interesting story, but it almost becomes an illegal story. When we met with these young men, Dr. Haas said to them, "You would have never done this against the Society of Black Engineers. Why did you decide to spoof SWE?" And they said, "Well, we were afraid of the black students." They weren't afraid of the women. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, where do you go with this kind of ignorance and this kind of prejudice? And she went through the administration and the advisor, and she said, "We have to take some action to assure that something similar against any student organization never occurs at Purdue University again." And she certainly made it happen.
Okay. What do you think made SWE so successful on campus that it became the largest student organization?
Well, I think the Women in Engineering program made a significant difference. It told the students that not only the program, but the faculty, the administration wanted them there and hoped that they would succeed. So I just think it created a wonderful environment for them. It also, as I mentioned, they were an extraordinarily talented group of women students that even applied to the university. So for a good 10 years, we were the only school that had a women in engineering program. And then there was one more. And then 5 years later, there might have been one more. So during all that time, our enrollments went very high, had a great proportion of women students, went over 20%. And that was just unheard of nationally. Mm-hmm. So I think that getting those exceptional students and having a supportive environment for them just made the organization soar. We took a lot of time and attention into making sure that it was good and strong, and the leaders that the students chose were amazing. Mm-hmm. I can think of the first year that I attended the SWE conference was 79, I think, and SWE won the National Best Student Section Award. And we had, I believe, we had like 20 students at convention, at conference. At that time, it was split. There was a student conference followed by the professional conference. And so you can imagine 20 from one school was very unusual in those days. Now it's not so. But.
Right, right. You said that for about 10 years, Purdue was the only university that had a women in engineering
Correct.
Program. Can you talk about when WePan came into this?
Sure. It was quite a bit down the road.
Okay.
And what happened was that since Purdue was the first and the only for a long time, a lot of other deans would call us and say, "How did you do that? How'd you get it started?" Then it became, if they did decide to hire someone or make someone responsible for women students in engineering, it became, "What kind of programs do you do? How do you reach out to high school students?" And we published a lot about what we did at the American Society for Engineering Education and talked about it at SWE conferences. So you would have SWE advisors that would be not really jealous in a negative sense, but wishful that they had such a institutional program on their campuses. On other campuses, it was the female engineering faculty who were having to do all this in addition to being judged on their technical work and their ability to teach. So it was quite a strain for the female faculty to be expected to do all this. So a lot of them went to their deans and asked, you know, could we follow Purdue's lead and hire someone from outside? This is kind of an interesting evolution, too. In the beginning, most of the directors of women in engineering were like myself, with educational or sociology or psychology backgrounds. Very few, I can't think of any at that time, that had an engineering degree themselves. Now it's quite common to have the directors of women in engineering be women who have worked as engineers for 10 or 15 years, some less, some more, and decide at some point in their life the idea of an academic career is kind of interesting to them. Maybe they want to understand education better. Maybe they have small children that the university setting is appealing to them. All kinds of different reasons. But now if you look at directors of women in engineering, it's quite a bit, quite a few more women that have worked as engineers and have engineering degrees.
Okay. So when did... how did you gather
people together?
You
started with this with WePan. Sorry, I forgot where I was going with that. Because so many people asked us for advice, I was spending almost as much time helping other colleges and universities get started, do some programs, as I was on my own job. And so Susan Matz, who was another co-founder of WePan, was at Stevens Institute. And I kind of think of their program as the second one in the United States. And they hired Susan in 1978 when they became co-ed. They had been an all-male engineering college before that. And so they hired Susan at that time. So she and I would always get together at ASEE, the Association of Engineering Education meetings, and tell what we were doing and get together with female faculty and talk to them about what we were doing. And she, too, was beginning to get a lot of requests for her to visit and talk and consult with other universities. So along came Suzanne Brainerd, the third founder of WePan, and she was starting a brand new program at the University of Washington. And so she was asking Susan and I for help, and we really worked closely, the three of us, together. And finally she said, "Aren't you guys getting tired of everybody calling you? Why don't we try and get a meeting and you can talk to everybody at once?" That was the birth of the idea. So I had kind of taken the lead at Purdue since we were the oldest and the most established. So I sent out a questionnaire to engineering deans and to SWE advisors asking if they would like to attend a meeting where we would talk about programs for women in engineering and how to start them and how to get funding for them and all those kind of important things. It was an amazing response. Like 90 some odd engineering schools wrote back very quickly that yes, they would be very interested in such a meeting and would send someone to the meeting. So we took the questionnaire and ourselves to NSF and spoke with a program director. At that time, there were no programs for women or girls, but they had a career access program. And so we talked to the director of that program, and he thought it was a good idea and accepted our proposal, and it was evaluated. And I think the first time it didn't go through, but the second time it did. And so in 1999, we had our first conference in Washington, D.C. And that was interesting. There were about 200 attendees and very high enthusiasm and interest in what we were talking about. And at the end of the meeting, we had sort of an open forum just to ask people what they thought should happen next. Should we try to get together at the SWE conference the next year? Should we try to get together at the ASEE conference the next year? And interestingly and kind of unexpected, they all wanted a separate organization. And I think it was because there were divided interests. The people that were there that were professors were willing to do something at ASEE, but at that meeting they had so many other responsibilities and interests. And the same thing with anyone that was a SWE advisor. You know, when they were at the SWE conference, they had other things they were interested in doing instead of meeting with this group. So they asked if we would look into starting an organization, and we did. And the rest is history, as I say. But yeah, it was a very exciting time.
Okay. Do you feel like WEPAN helped to increase the number or increase the quality of women in engineering programs?
I do, amazingly so. In the beginning years, we got two more grants for 3 years each to actually do training seminars where we would cover specific topics like fundraising and pre-college programs and retention programs and in the later days, faculty programs. How do you talk and work with faculty to get them to understand how they could improve the classroom? And so it was, it was definitely a help to them. And these training seminars went on. We called them regional training seminars. We held three a year in the East Coast, Midwest, and West Coast, and had good attendance at all of them. All of them were grants from the National Science Foundation, so that NSF really helped us develop as an organization.
Okay. I saw that you spent a year at the National Science Foundation. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. In 1992, NSF decided to begin a special program in the Educational Directorate for women in science and engineering. They called it the Program for Women and Girls, and now it's the Research on Gender program. It was very much as NSF is focused on, it focused on research about women in science and engineering. It took quite a while before they started really funding programmatic things, and then it really had to be on a fairly large scale. They wouldn't like fund the Women in Engineering program at Purdue University. They would fund a consortium of colleges and universities that wanted to understand programs better, understand what worked and what didn't work. So it was always kind of research-based. And it wasn't only focused on colleges and universities. We, in the very first year, which was when I went to NSF in 93, it was the first year we made grants, and we had grants to the Girl Scouts and to other what the girls' organization is. Oh, shoot. There was a math science consortium out in California that worked on programs for girls. I can't remember the acronym at all. I'm sorry. It was like Project SMART or something. Mm-hmm. Girls Incorporated.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was a lot of organizations that focused on the education of girls and not so much on adult women at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Why did you decide to spend a year there?
Because it was the first. And actually, you know, a lot of things that happen, at least my perception in life, are just coincidences and opportunities that present themselves, and it's whether you're able to grasp them or whether you're interested in grasping them that makes your life up. You know, it's just a series of doors that open, and do you go through them or don't you? Well, they had just started this program, and Marcia Mattis was the very first director there, and she was a Purdue University biologist that was interested in women's and girls' issues in science. And so she actually wrote the program announcement soliciting grant applications from people. And then she said, I don't want to do this full time. She said, I'm just on loan from, she was working for the American Physiological Society at that time. And she said, would you consider coming in on loan? And NSF did a lot of that. I would say 2/3 of the employees when I was there were on loan from other organizations. And you worked there between 1 to 3 years and then went back to your institution. And you actually remained an employee of your institution. NSF would pay as a grant back to your institution, and my checks and my benefits and everything would continue to be coming from Purdue University. So she asked if I would be interested, and I was. So I interviewed for that job. It was the year I tell people I ran away from home, because it was a year I was divorced after 23 years of marriage. My son was in his late teens, so he was kind of out on his own already. And I felt like, you know, there's nothing, no reason why I shouldn't take advantage of this. Mm-hmm. So I told people I ran away from home and went to Washington and really, really enjoyed that opportunity and learned so much. I know we'll talk later about my work at the Luce Foundation. And I think the reason I was so appealing to the Luce Foundation was because of the work I'd done at NSF with proposals and soliciting grant applications and that sort of thing.
Okay. So what led you to leave Purdue and to go to the Henry Luce Foundation?
Interesting. I mentioned earlier in our interview about the difficult department chair I had, and it really started getting me seriously thinking about, do I want to do something else before I would retire? Well, the Luce Foundation called me at Purdue one day, and we had actually had a grant for graduate fellowships from the Luce program. So we were familiar with the program and had interacted with the woman who was in charge of the program at that time. And one day the president of the foundation called me, and I didn't realize she was leaving or they were making any changes. And he said, "Are you interested in the Claire Booth Luce program?" And I said, "Oh, yeah, very interested," thinking we might get another grant for graduate fellowships from the program. So I said, "Yes, I'm very interested." And he said, "Oh, I was hoping you'd say that." He said, "Your name's been given to us, and we'd like to, would you send us a resume?" And I thought, well, that's a little odd, but NSF at that time was starting to require you to submit resumes with your grant applications. So it wasn't totally off the wall. So I sent him a resume. Didn't hear anything. And literally 7 or 8 months later, the president calls back and he said, "I'm sorry, we've been so long," but he said, "We've been reviewing your resume," and he said, "We'd like to talk with you further about the Claire Booth Luce program if you're still interested." I said, "Yes, I was still interested." So he said, "Well, what are you doing on like April the 16th at 1 p.m.?" And I said, "Oh, I have an appointment at that time." I said, "Can we talk earlier in the day or later in the day?" And he said, "Well, where's your appointment?" And I said, "In my office." And he said, "No, we want you to come to New York." And I said, "You want me to come to New York to talk about whether Purdue's going to get a grant for graduate fellowships?" And he goes, no, we want to talk to you about running the program." And I thought, oh my gosh, he thinks I am so stupid. He will never want me running this program now. So I said, "Oh, can you give me a minute to think about that?" And he goes, "Okay." So literally there was silence on the line for about 30 seconds. And then he goes, "Well," and I said, "Okay, I'll come out and talk with you." Well, the idea of working in New York City was like, no, I didn't want to do that. Interestingly, this is kind of, I guess, something nobody knows about, but one time when they were searching for an executive director for SWE, I was approached about doing that. And because the office was in New York, I said no. You know, I had no interest in leaving Purdue University and going to New York City. Well, it was a different time. It was a different point in my personal life and in my career. I was feeling like I was getting stale at what I was doing. I wasn't bringing the energy or the enthusiasm to the job. I'd actually been at Purdue long enough to officially retire from the university. So I went out and talked with them about it, and just after the interview, which was actually no longer than 2.5 hours, I met the president and I met the chair of the board, who was Henry Luce IV. And that was it. It was over. And I thought when I left there, I want this job really badly. Well, interestingly enough, guess who the other candidates were that they were interviewing? Susan Metz and Suzanne Brainerd, my co-founders of WePen. So it was like, oh, shoot. You know, we had never competed against each other for anything. Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately, neither one of them were quite as interested in it as I was. And again, I think because of the work at NSF that I had done, and by that time had started the WePen program organization, I think that I was very... I had the characteristics and the experience that they really valued. It was an interesting time at the program because they had, in the past, it had been very much, the selection of the universities that received the grants were very much based on reputation of the university and not on anything about women in science or engineering, because their program directors had no history or understanding of issues of gender in science and technology. So they had had an evaluation of the program done, and the evaluation team had told them to seek a candidate who'd had a lot of experience working with women and girls in programs. So the rest is history. They offered me the job. I loved it. Had 11 years out there before I retired again after retiring from Purdue. And just had a wonderful time there.
Okay. How long had the Claire Booth Luce program existed before you came?
Right. The first grants were made in 99, and I went in, that's not right, 89. And I went in 2001, so a little over 10 years.
Okay.
But like I said, it was not managed by anyone who understood issues. So one of the things I was delighted to be able to do early on was to help the selection committee, which was a group of six people that were appointed by the Luce Foundation and the Heritage Foundation, which was a kind of interesting twist. Claire Booth Luce was politically a very conservative person and was very active in the Heritage Foundation. But talk about people who are kind of not knowledgeable about issues that benefit women. Here we had three board members from the Heritage Foundation and three from the Luce Foundation, one of whom, of the six, was actually a science faculty member. The others were from many, many different fields. Some university presidents, you know, they were amazing individuals. The president of the Heritage Foundation was on the committee, but they didn't have knowledge about issues. So that was the most interesting, challenging, and fun part of my job, was helping them understand how to select a recipient. We didn't select individuals to receive the money. We selected institutions. Mm-hmm. So I talked with them, and thankfully they understood and agreed very early on that they wanted the grants to go to institutions that understood that the education of women and girls in science and engineering was different than it was for men. And so they asked me to develop a set of guidelines, as had been done at NSF, to say, okay, how do you know if a university is good? So I developed a selection system, an application system, where we looked at just very kind of global statistics, but we asked how many women had been chosen, had been recruited to teach at the universities in the last 15 years, how many of them were still there, how many of them had been promoted to associate professor or full professor. We did the same thing with students, how many students were in science and engineering disciplines 15 years ago, how many now. Did they have any special programs for beginning students, for outreach to colleges or to high schools and grade schools? And by that, we were able to at least get kind of a global picture of whether they were attentive to women's issues on campus and that sort of thing. So they still use the application process I came up with. And the committee, as committee members retired, we did get a few more engineering or science faculty in, but we also held conferences where experts on gender in science and technology spoke with them. Shirley Malcolm from AAAS was a speaker one year, and certainly Susan Metz and Suzanne Brainerd came and talked with them about the engineering side of things. So I think they became much more knowledgeable and made better choices in my mind. We weren't putting scholarships or fellowships or particularly professorships in institutions where they weren't committed to those individuals succeeding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I'd like to jump to SWE.
Sure.
So you became involved with SWE as the SWE advisor for Purdue. Mm-hmm. When did you start becoming involved beyond being the
advisor?
At
the national level, Mark?
Right.
It was a long time. you know, I mostly went to conferences for the students to support their leadership in the society on campus and that sort of thing. I'm trying to think, perhaps with WEPAN, so maybe 10 years after I began as a SWE member and an advisor, that we really started looking at the institution. There was a Women in Academia committee that was very sparsely attended in those days. Now it's pretty rigorous and vital. So there was not a whole lot of attention to women in academia other than the students, but not the faculty. So I would say maybe 10 or 11 years later that I started working with the Women in Academia committee and doing that sort of thing. Recognition came, and that was certainly appreciated, and I think that got me committed to the organization's advancement and work itself as a society. I was privileged to receive the Distinguished Service Award and then become a fellow, which was interesting because I'd been a member for 20 some odd years, but they had never made a non-engineer a fellow. And I know there was some controversy, and rightfully so, some people that weren't sure that you should be a fellow in an organization if you weren't, if you didn't have the academic and professional background in engineering. So that was kind of a major leap for the organization, and it certainly made me much more committed to the organization, that they really valued what I brought to the organization.
Okay. What are some of your fond memories
of SWE? Yeah. The first conference was amazing. All the conferences were wonderful. To see our students get energized and excited about the work on campus that they were doing. And because they were such a large section, it was sort of like we were with the Women in Engineering program. The other SWE sections on campuses looked to them, whether it was at the national meeting or the regional meeting, to sort of tell them, how did they get all these members and how did they get so many programs and activities? They had a corporate advisory board before SWE National had a corporate advisory board. And that was a huge help. They solicited support, financial support and programmatic support from alums long before anyone else did that. So, yeah, it was just the excitement of working with them and then seeing them as alums stay active in the SWE organization. So when I'd come to conferences, it would be really exciting. At some point in time, we began having a booth at the exhibit to talk about graduate school to undergraduate students. And now, again, I started it probably before I left Purdue, obviously, but so maybe 15 years ago, having a dessert or a breakfast now it's a breakfast where Purdue alums are invited at the national conference to come and see one another, and that's always an exciting event.
Okay. When did you become involved with the editorial board?
After I retired, actually. I was looking at the volunteer list because now I had some time to give back to the organization, and two things appealed to me. One was ABET. SWE was just beginning to have involvement with a representative on the ABET board, the Accreditation Board for Engineering and Technology. And so I, on the, when you get your list of committees and who would like to do what, I put down the ABET representative and the editorial board. And mostly I just wanted to find a way that I could stay involved in the organization, but in retirement, I could still attend meetings and things without financial support and without financial hardship to me. So I agreed the ABET position should have gone to an engineering faculty member, and it did. And I think that's a good choice. And then the editorial board was interested in having me participate and was willing to help with travel to conferences and the meeting in the off months. And so that's why I decided to do that.
Okay. How do you contribute to the editorial board?
Well, as a member originally, now as a chair, I think I bring a vast breadth of experience that's away from the traditional technical part of engineering. And since the Society magazine and publications and social media, I think, are much more focused on the development of the woman rather than on helping her be a better mechanical engineer or a better electrical engineer, it's a really good fit for me because I've done research, I've studied, you know, how women select careers, how they advance in careers, and that sort of thing. So it's a wonderful fit for me as far as brainstorming ideas about what to put in the magazine. And
You've been involved with SWE since 1978. How has SWE changed?
Dramatically. dramatically and positively. Like the evolution of women in engineering programs on campuses, SWE as an organization has evolved in wonderful ways. And it's changed. And again, I hope none of this sounds terribly negative, but my first experiences, well, I can even tell you an anecdote. At that first conference, a female engineer who was in her probably 50s or 60s sat around a table with all of our Purdue students and myself and was asking them what they were planning to do and what area of engineering. And she got to me at the end of the round of students, and she said, "And you, sweetie, well, how about you?" And I said, "Well, I'm not an engineering student or an engineer." I said, "I'm their advisor, and my background's in education and counseling, student services." And she said, "Well, honey, I think you can have a perfectly satisfying future even if you're not an engineer." And that was really kind of the attitude. It was like, who are these people that come to our conference and work with our students that don't have an engineering background? How'd that happen? You know, sort of thing. And so it evolved from that kind of attitude in the organization to one that really follows through on its value of diversity in a much broader sense, you know, valuing the diversity of thinking and the diversity of experience that all of us that are interested and belong to the organization bring to the table. So I've seen that kind of huge evolution. The commitment to women in academia has certainly grown. The growth of the corporate interest in SWE is huge. I mean, there were a few companies that were involved in those early conferences that I attended. But absolutely nothing like you see now. I mean, it's just obviously an organization that is so valued and so respected for the work they do. The other change that I am very excited about is the interest and the knowledge that they share with us from the administration about, I don't want to say legal issues, but policy issues in the government. That's something that was just unknown to most of us. How do you think about that? How do you ever make a difference with what the Senate or what the Congress does in voting on policy? And SWE's really become much more active in that regard.
Is there anything that you're less excited about?
Not really.
Okay.
No, I think the evolution and the changes have all been very, very positive.
Okay.
The leadership of the organization, I think, took a big turn when they hired Betty Shanahan as she was the first engineer that had been hired into the executive director position. And again, it's that molding of experience and commitment to not just the technology and the technical background of its members, but to the personal growth of its members. And so it kind of married those two interests. And then with Karen having such vast experience both in the STEM organizations and in technical recruiting and work herself, I think it's just been a wonderful evolution in leadership too.
Okay. What would you like to see SWE do in the future?
That's a tough one. I don't know, because I don't know what the future is going to bring. I mean, like this involvement in government that's fairly recent. I don't know what the next frontier will be. So I would just say keep growing with what they're doing and keep their finger on the pulse of what's going on in corporations, in the government, in academia. so that they're not playing catch up, but they're leading the way as they have.
Okay. Do you think that women will ever get close to being 50%?
50-50 in 2050? I don't know. I don't know. Because, you know, just historically, many occupations have been gendered. Mm-hmm. They're certainly gendered the other direction mm-hmm. with nursing and now almost all medical and even biomedical engineering. You know, it is 50-50. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that across the board it'll ever be 50-50. But I do think there's already large enough proportions and numbers in most fields, some not yet, but in most fields that women's experiences and women's diversity has an impact on corporations and on society in general. So I don't know. And I don't know that it's that important. You know, yeah, it would be wonderful to see, but it is seen in some specific areas. So mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have any advice for current or future women engineers with your counseling background?
Yeah, I think about that a lot when I was on campus, because I guess I at least, and I imagine a lot of people, look at their own lives and their own career progress to see, you know, what could I help students learn to, so that they wouldn't make mistakes I made or wouldn't take the wrong turns I took. The one thing that always comes to mind is every time someone asked me to do something that I wasn't positive I could really do or had the experience or capabilities to do, if they encouraged me to stretch myself and I did it, it was always a positive outcome. And so I guess my advice is just to any student or any person, just take advantage of things that you're asked to do that aren't comfortable all the time. They're like, oh, I'm not sure. Do it. Take a risk and just stretch yourself to do new things and to take new opportunities and run with them.
Okay. Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
I can't think of anything. You're very thorough with what you asked. I don't think so.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for sitting down to do this interview. And this is the end of the interview.